And I'm your host, David Saltzman. We are joined today by Vinay Patel, who is founder at Mako RX, also happens to be a doctor of pharmacy, knows all things pharmacy. And we thought that we'd talk a little bit about some of the innovations that are happening in the broad pharmacy marketplace, but not maybe the stuff that you've heard about so much. Maybe we could title this, Vinay, maybe we could title this Everything Old is New Again, because we're going to start by talking about the role of a group of organizations that I don't think a lot of people know about called community pharmacies. And they are going to, I think, and I think you agree, play an increasingly more visible and important role. So can you level set for us? What is a community pharmacy, or what are community pharmacies?
Community pharmacies are, first off, David, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here on the podcast, and the guests that you have on here among them. So thank you for the opportunity. So let's dig into the questions. Community pharmacies are these local hometown pharmacies that most people have probably forgotten about or don't realize that they're there in the community because of the national brands having such a prominence on a lot of street corners. And when you're driving to and from work or driving to and from school, you see a lot of these names that sort of reinforce the national pharmacy brands. But these community pharmacies are your local hometown pharmacies that are owned by mom and pops that are around the community, and they run and operate these pharmacies, and they serve the community with an extra level of personal touch that you may not necessarily get at the big box stores. So just, you know, people that you know in your community that would own a small business, these are pharmacists that own these small pharmacies that exist in these communities, and you just got to sort of find them out and know where to look for them to really engage with them.
Well, it's almost like a throwback, isn't it? I mean, these were folks who were there before there were the big box stores, the big names that start with W and C, and all those ones that we all know. And they were on Main Street, and they were little pharmacies, and they would compound drugs, and it was kind of a different marketplace back in the day. And then the larger houses came in. How have these folks managed to survive? I mean, it seems like kind of the Walmart conversation you always have about Walmart kind of obliterating the sun for a lot of other similar small businesses. How have they managed to survive? What's the unique role that they still play?
Community pharmacies today, throughout this transition that you mentioned, David, with the big box stores representing or having more of a prevalent role in cities and communities and towns, they've had to change where they sort of fit into the marketplace. So, you know, back in, if you want to talk about the early 90s, late 90s, early 2000s, it was pretty much a level playing field. If you were in healthcare and you walked into one pharmacy and you ran the insurance, it was, you know, about the same cost, and the prices were about the same, and people were buying it. There was a lot of competition because there weren't as much oligopolies or consolidation in healthcare to create, you know, sort of these narrow places, you know, just a few places to buy drugs from, or competition around the insurance marketplace. So it was about the same, and it didn't matter. And then things started getting hot and heavy after the Medicare Modernization Act, with Medicare Part D came in, and we thought there was an opportunity. Well, there was a lot more people coming into pharmacies because now they had drug coverage and they wanted to utilize this drug coverage. And that sort of kick-started things, and it all accelerated after the Affordable Care Act went into place, and even more people now have coverage than before. And so they've had to really mold or modify or customize their offering. What they've always specialized in is service and quality. You know, they were just a great place that a pharmacist knew you and knew your family, knew what medicines you were taking, could communicate with your provider, knew who the doctor was in the community, and get problems resolved fairly quickly. And then they had to go into compounding, which was sort of another area, or medical supplies that they would have to, you know, that they would go into that area to find an opportunity to compete again with the big box stores. And then, of course, health insurance really sort of turned the levers against community pharmacy, particularly with how much money they're extracting from the pharmacy and from patients and from everyone in the system now, where they, you know, they can't survive just, you know, making less than what they cost them for these medications. from the insurance reimbursement. So they've really just gone cash. There's some pharmacies that have gone cash, some pharmacies that have just specialized in, like, you know, just specialize in compounding now. They don't offer anything else. Or, you know, finding other ways to survive, just finding the drugs that can help make their make a little bit of margin on so that they can focus on those or the patients that really have the insurances that are reimbursing enough to survive.
You know, you said something that was interesting a moment ago. You talked about, you know, back in the day, you could go to pharmacy A, pharmacy B, pharmacy C, and ask the price of a particular med, and it was about the same, one to the other to the other. Would it be fair to say that there was more transparency back there than there is now?
If you ask, there was more transparency, yes. And then the insurance companies were, again, they were all pretty much negotiated or contracted about the same rates. But yeah, I'd say it was easier. There wasn't dozens of prices for a drug. There were probably, you know, three or four different prices depending on where you went and who had, you know, slightly better deal.
So when we talk about transparency, which is kind of the most overused word at this point, I think, in our industry for a lot of reasons, and we also talk about PBM reform, how do those two things, A, go together, and B, how do you make them happen together?
It's going to take an act of Congress to really combine these two things to allow for more transparency in the pharmacy benefits marketplace or the industry, if you will. What we think will happen when we have more transparency is that if all of the costs for a medication or all of the discounts for a medication are taken into account, and we know where all those streams of money are going from the drug companies, you know, between the drug companies and these pharmacy benefit companies, then we can hopefully get to one fixed price that we know everyone should be getting, or there's a standard that says, you know, here's exactly what happened a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, when we had this hospital pricing transparency, where now people are able to shop and understand the true cost of some of these services at a hospital rather than relying on the charge master. And so we hope that this will allow the same thing to happen in drug pricing, where we just have a full clarity on all the discounts on a medication, where those monies are going, where they're coming from, and we can all sort of negotiate off this benchmark that's established across the country. But it's really going to take Congress to figure out all of those pieces when there's a ton of money, lobbying money, flowing in to prevent a lot of this from happening. And it's really going to, in our opinion, be a super difficult thing, although the new administration that's coming into office on Monday has stated multiple times that they want to take on this industry. They want to help make healthcare or drug pricing more affordable for Americans, and we believe them. It's what's the deal, though? We had, you know, a semblance of something that was going into the Continuing Resolution Act to fund the government, but all that got swiped, you know, sort of deleted to just fund the government. That's all we need is a temporary extension. So now we can take a full swing at it and figure out what that looks like. And there's a million different ways to slice this, skin this cat, as they say.
Other than the folks in the new administration, are there any champions on the Hill for this? Because as you mentioned, the amount of money that Big Pharma drops into Congress is, for lack of a better word, breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
Are there particular legislators who are, like, taking this up as a cause?
There are. There's a representative from Georgia, Buddy Carter. He's a pharmacist, and he's been championing this for a long time on the House side. There are several senators that aren't coming to name now, but from, I want to say, Iowa or Kansas, somewhere in the Midwest, there's a couple senators out there. Josh Hawley's name has come up a lot in terms of, you know, speaking out against what we can do against, you know, sort of making drug pricing more transparent and against the pharmacy benefit companies. Bernie Sanders has taken on, you know, the pharma industry and the pharmacy insurance or the insurance industry as well. So there's several people. I can tell you that this is a bipartisan issue. It's not one side or the other. Everyone agrees healthcare is broken, drug pricing is unaffordable, we need to fix this. It's going to be a how. So there's definitely a lot of interest, and there's definitely, because of the public frustration around healthcare and drug pricing affordability, there's a lot of interest in solving this problem.
Do you see a particular role for the community pharmacies in moving this forward?
There's been a lot of advocacy, yes. There's an organization that that community pharmacies are rolled up under called Pharmacists United Against Truth and Transparency, or Pharmacists United for Truth and Transparency, that has a lot of community pharmacies in that organization. That's an advocacy organization. And I have a lot of respect for the hard work that Jeremy Counts and his team does on Capitol Hill and state legislators as well to try to create reform and a level playing field for community pharmacies. But it's not just them, really, David. We've seen a lot of collateral damage, if you will, with the big box stores as well, Walgreens and CVS seeing a lot of headwinds around reimbursements. It just affects the small guys exponentially more than the big boxes.
Yeah, but, as you lift the rocks and you let all the critters scurry out, somebody once said sunshine's the best disinfectant. And I think there's a lot that folks don't know. Meanwhile, I know that, you're working on some unique, we'll call them ways of helping folks. One of them is something called a subscription RX program. Mm-hmm. What's that all about? How does that work?
So the great question. That is a membership program. We call it the same thing, subscription membership program, where folks can access over 300 medications, commonly used generic drugs, at no cost from our network of local community pharmacies. And that's through our cost plus reimbursement. We have this network of over 20,000 pharmacies across the country where you can access cost plus pricing. And now it's transparent to the point where we know the hardest thing in pharmacy is how much is the drug going to cost? And the first thing that the pharmacy tells you is, well, I don't know until I run it through your insurance or run it through your plan. Now we know the cost of every medication because of our cost plus model, where we say, look, the foundation is this national average drug acquisition cost, and that's what we reimburse pharmacies, plus a dispensing fee. I can actually tell you what the cost of that medication will be before you even go to the pharmacy, before anyone ever runs it through your insurance. And now, because we know that cost, we can then create this subscription model where folks pay, folks that either have high deductible plans or folks that are employed but don't have access to insurance. Hospitality industry is a big one where a lot of folks just don't have access, can afford the health insurance, even if it's offered, or high deductible plans where you're paying a ton of money outside before the insurance even kicks in. This layered on plan, which is month to month, it's not signed. You don't sign up for a year. It's whenever you're on as an employee, you can get access to the plan if your employer offers it. And when you're no longer working or can't afford it for whatever reason, you can come off the plan, and that's on a month to month basis. And through this monthly fixed fee, you get access to these drugs and everything else. Even if it's not on the free list, you get access to the cost plus pricing at the pharmacy transparently. So, that there's no one making extra money off on the drug. It's all going to the pharmacist to dispense that medication to you. And then just affordability and access is really the two problems we're trying to solve with that product.
One of the other things that I think finally, after almost 30 years, making its way and figuring out its path is direct primary care. I know there's a whole bunch of different models that are starting to answer some of the employer questions that they've had about demonstrable, repeatable ROIs and all those kinds of things. And you've got a program that goes hand in glove with DPC practices, which seems innovative to me. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's a version of our subscription program that's specifically built for the patients that are part of direct primary care. And it provides the same benefits, access to these 300, this list of the 300 most commonly used drugs in the country at no cost from our preferred pharmacies, and then access to cost plus pricing as well. But it's specifically tailored for all of the patients that go through and to direct primary care practices.
Let me ask the question this way. What role, if any, do you think that these discount cards like GoodRx have had in opening consumers' eyes to the fact that, holy cow, they might actually be able to pay less than their copay for the same drug?
The funniest thing in healthcare is that insurance has now oftentimes become the most expensive option. You think that you have insurance, that it's supposed to save you money, you get sort of good pricing, access, economies of scale. It's crazy that your insurance company is probably going to charge you a price that's higher than what you would pay if you just paid cash, or you said, what's the cash price? And when GoodRx was first created, I think it created a lot more visibility, awareness of here's what drugs, you know, should cost and do cost versus what the insurance company's charging you at the pharmacy. What's happened after that transparency, it brought a lot more awareness for sure, is that it's these cards, these discount cards, are also clawing back money from the pharmacies where sometimes they're losing money on these prescriptions. And so now the consumer has awareness, this is what the drug should be, and I'm going to demand this price when I go to the pharmacy because I see what the drug should cost, and that's great. But when they use these cards, particularly at community pharmacies, the clawback on these discount cards is significant enough where the pharmacy can't accept them, or they have, you know, they'll tell you there's another option. And now the second level of this is GoodRx has actually gotten embedded into insurance. The state health plan here in North Carolina, I don't know if they were aware or not, but they have a there's a special contract with CVS Caremark where GoodRx was able to embed their pricing into the insurance that the state health plan offers. So when a member went to a pharmacy, if the GoodRx price was cheaper than the insurance price, the GoodRx price would actually get applied to the pharmacy. No one knew any better, no one knew any different. The pharmacy's doing their same thing. The patient thought they were using their insurance. And now you have a huge problem with pharmacies getting under reimbursed for these same medications, and they didn't even know or ask or use GoodRx. And so now we're getting to the point where it's being embedded into insurance as sort of a way, a pathway around the health insurance system, but maybe causing more problems than it's helping.
Well, and pharmacy margins, most people don't know this, but pharmacy margins are not what people think they are. They're very, very thin.
That's right.
And labor intensive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you start having clawbacks, I wasn't aware of that. So that's it's an interesting wrinkle. Another place to, for us maybe to investigate for a few minutes is I know one of the things that you guys talk about, I know it's on your website and some other places that you've written, is non-traditional PBMs. When you talk about non-traditional PBMs, what does that mean?
It's the smaller PBMs that people typically just don't aren't aware about because the big three control 80% of the marketplace. And so these non-traditional PBMs are, you know, these smaller, usually transparent PBMs that are able to compete on quality and service and get access to similar pricing. What's funny is that, you know, as small as we are, we're able to showcase that the again, healthcare is just unlike any other industry in the country, where you think that okay, Caremark's got, you know, 10 million people or 20 million people that it provides pharmacy benefits for. Surely they're getting the best prices for these drugs, and we've seen time and time again where, when you know, depending on how it's structured, the prices for medications are just not being passed on to the plan sponsors. And through the cost-plus model, we're able to just, again, transparently show, here's the cost of the drug, here's what you're paying the pharmacy, and here's how much you can save, regardless of how many millions of lives there are that are negotiating these drug prices with these drug companies. Now, brand drugs are a different story altogether. Rebates are sort of the number one mechanism to try to eliminate or reduce the price for those, and that's now a big question of how much of those rebates are being passed on to plan sponsors, and there's other fees for drugs. It's not just rebates, but service admin fees and drug access fees and so on and so forth that we have to contend with as well now. And so that's who these small players are. Right Way, we've probably heard a lot about Right Way taking on Tyson Foods now this year. 7-Eleven, Purdue University also moved to a smaller PBM called Affirmed Rx this year as well. And so that's what the non-traditional pharmacy benefit companies in general are.
Well, and now you're layering on top of that all of the current talk about fiduciary responsibilities.
Yeah.
In light of the J&J lawsuit and some others, of course. And, you know, folks don't realize they don't, you know, they kind of don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to learn. As we wrap up, look into your crystal ball and tell me what this looks like a couple, 3 years from now. What do you see the industry, your side of the industry looking like? What will have happened in your best guesses?
I'll give you two scenarios. If Congress can't act to significantly reform the industry, nothing changes. There's a momentum, there's talk, These lawsuits, they may have some sizzle depending on how they play out. They may just get settled and we may never hear about them ever again. And large employer groups may just decide we're just going to stick with the status quo. Mm-hmm. And the big just keep getting bigger. Consolidation continues to happen in healthcare. And it sort of everything eviscerates around these healthcare providers. Although I'd like to hope differently. If Congress acts and creates significant reform, which could happen as simply as one thing, David, if Congress decides that they want to eliminate rebates from the Safe Harbor Act, then that one thing alone could help everyone realize what these net prices are for these drugs. There's no more kickbacks in terms of rebates from drug companies to pharmacy benefit companies, and or breaking up the big three into smaller regional PBMs, similar to what we did with Ma Bell in the late 70s. And that creates competition, enough competition, with all these other non-traditional PBMs, which there are about 60 of them in the country, to compete on quality, service, and cost now. And in that scenario, we have companies that have decided that in 3 years from now, we got more and more companies from large to small, mid-size market up that they want to utilize another option, another alternative to the big three PBMs. And then we have 40%, 50% of the market using non-traditional PBMs. We have more transparency in terms of drug prices. We don't have perverse incentives where pharma has to increase prices to keep up with the rebate demands that pharmacy benefit companies may be asking for formulary access and market share. And we have a pathway to a more reasonable, sustainable healthcare system in terms of the employer market than we have ever before that I can think of, with it just going one direction with, you know, this consolidation.
Well, that's a great place to end our conversation for today, but we hope you'll come back as the crystal ball gets a little less murky and maybe we have a different conversation about how things are actually changing. Vinay Patel, thank you so much, founder at Mako RX, and we appreciate you sharing your expertise with our audience.
David, thanks so much for the opportunity. It was a pleasure.